Thank you, Patricia. And I just want to start out by thanking all of you for coming here. This is a topic that is obviously very important to my work, but also just very important to me personally. And I really do cherish these opportunities to talk to people about it and to explain to them this, because it's something that I think is really important to everyone. So as Patricia mentioned, I used to do beekeeping research. I currently run about 85 hives a little bit northwest of here, about 40 minutes from here, near Stockbridge, Michigan. But I've been a beekeeper all of my life. I started when I was a kid with my dad. We kept bees in our backyard. So I started over 20 years ago, and back in the era before a lot of the problems started, so back in that era where we call it like the golden age of beekeeping, where you could just set out hives in your backyard and put some boxes out and take honey off in the fall, and everything was really lovely. And as many of you know, that's a really different scenario that we have now. And so when I moved to Michigan, which I did go to U of M for my PhD, so I have both allegiances to both places. But when I moved here about 8 years ago and I started keeping bees again here, and it was just a completely different scenario. So my background's in disease transmission in humans, but during the time I was doing my work here, I was keeping bees and seeing the struggle with that. And so I was able to do my postdoc work at Michigan State studying honeybee diseases. Okay, it's going to start with a quiz though. So what is pollination? Yeah, so moving pollen from one plant to another. And basically, and that pollen is important because this is essentially how flowering plants reproduce. So here's an example of cross-pollination. You see a little bee. It goes to one little flower. And the pollen from the stamens, which are these parts, stick to the flower to collect food. It attaches to the bee. Often that's an electrostatic attachment, or it'll actually put these little packets on here, and then it'll bring it to another plant. And that's important because that's what we call causes fruit set. So it allows the plant to reproduce. When plants reproduce, they form seeds. And a lot of the ways that plants are able to transport those seeds is by providing fruit. And so what happens is you have the pollen come in, and it goes down into the ovary of the flower, and it actually causes the seeds to be formed, and it causes the fruit to get made. So that's really important for plants, because that's the only way that a lot of these plants can reproduce. Without this activity, they don't get to form seeds, and they don't get to form fruit. And that's really important for us, too, as humans, because this is what we eat. So here's a tomato, but there's lots of other fruits and plants. So what other fruits and plants require pollination? Apples. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so roses, yeah, and you'll get the rose hip out of that. Cherries, that's a big one too in Michigan. And so it's probably, the saying is that it's a third of our food supply, one out of every three bites of food. This is a diagram that Whole Foods has just recently put out, and here's their produce section, and this is just bee pollination. So this is produce section with bees. And this is what it would look like if you didn't have bees. So it's probably, in terms of produce, it's about at least a third of the foods that we eat absolutely require this process to happen. And in the absence of this process, we don't get foods. And you can just see on this list, too, and this is not a complete list, but apples, onions, avocados, carrots, mangoes, lemons, limes, pretty much all of the good things. And so not as in foods, but just all of the really nutritious foods as well. So a lot of the fruits that come off of fruit trees, but the cucurbits, like the squashes and cucumbers, and then also a lot of the brassicas, like cauliflower, broccoli, things like that. So a lot of the really nutritious, good-for-you foods. And this is an example where plants that get pollinated but don't get complete pollination. So you can have maybe one bee goes and visits a plant, but then it's not enough to actually pollinate the plant completely to get full pollination. So here's an apple, and you can see that it's growing kind of at an angle, and some pretty funky-looking strawberries. And I bet people have seen cucumbers that look like that, or when cucumbers or those yellow squashes grow at a curved angle, That's because, you know, a plant wants to be nice and round, and if every single part of it got completely pollinated, it would grow nice and round and straight. But when only part of it gets pollinated, that's the part that can grow. And some plants absolutely require pollination, so you won't get what's called a fruit set without it. And some plants do much better with pollination. But overall, we think it's about 150% increase by having pollinators really nearby. Okay, so who are our major pollinators? Bees are the big one. So I have a picture of that. There's a couple of species of bees. And they provide the most of it. But we also have butterflies, hummingbirds, bats produce our major pollinators. And you can see that they're, you know, all doing essentially the same thing. They're going into a flower, they're getting the pollen on top of them, and then they're going to transport that to another place. And if we don't have pollinators, it still has to happen. And so if you're in a place, so this is photos from China, there are some regions where the pollinators have been wiped out and aren't able to live, and pollination is actually occurring by hand. So that's a little blurry, but you can see that there's people up on ladders, and they actually buy little packets of pollen and take paintbrushes and put it in the flowers. Because if you don't have the pollen in the flowers, you don't start that activity to allow the fruit to form. And so if, in order for these food industries to exist, someone has to do it. And if the bees aren't there or if the pollinators aren't there, humans have to take over. Though they are trying to invent little pollinator robots. That is a thing that's happening. So this may be, these guys may be out of work pretty soon too. Some pollinators have really specific relationships with each other. So you can see up here it says this is a squash bee. That's its common name. And that's because it has a very, very specific relationship to the squash flower. So you can see them at work on, you know, these bright yellow big squash flowers. And this relationship evolved over millions of years. So as long as we've had flowers and they've had this reproductive method of reproducing with pollen, you've had bees or you've had pollinators. So we know that bees have gone back. So some of these have always been working with this flower for a very, very, very long time. Other plants do a lot better when they're pollinated by many different types of pollinators. So here's blueberries, and you can see a bee feeding on the blueberry flower. And at Michigan State, they just did a study that was actually published just this summer where they showed that if you had blueberries that were pollinated by one type of pollinator, they did fine, but when they're pollinated by many different types of pollinators, they actually did much better. And one of the reasons for that is the pollinators, they work very differently. There's even some that will be able to go in so deep into the flower, others will get it on their backs, others will cut a hole in the bottom of the flower to get in, and they'll be able to make that full, more complete pollination on a plant. But most foods are pollinated by the honeybee. And why is that? These are actually clues. These are my clues to tell you, remind me to tell you what it is. Well, the first reason is that we can transport them. So we can actually, they live in colonies, and we can take those colonies in boxes. So other pollinators live in sand, or they live in trees, or they live solitary. So you'd have to bring, you know, thousands of independent bees with you, which would be very difficult. But honeybees live in these big colonies that are easily transported. And the reason that we need to transport them is you can see this picture of an orchard there. It's a monoculture. And the only way that we can grow enough food for all the people is by growing it in these big, huge swatches of land. And you can see that these flowers, these plants are in bloom right now, which means that if you put bees on there, that would be a really great food source for them because that's where their food comes from, is these flowers. But once those flowers stop blooming, what's available for those bees in that area? Nothing. And so there aren't enough native pollinators. There aren't pollinators that are going to be around those plants. And so we actually, in these scenarios, we can't count on there being bees there because there's not going to be enough food to support colonies of bees naturally. And so we actually have to bring them in. So in our food industry, most of our pollination is done through the use of honeybees. And they're incredibly economically important. The estimates are that it's a $20 billion industry. So honeybees are really well studied. And so I am going to talk about honeybees for a while here, but just keep in mind that all these problems I talk about are affecting all of the other bees as well, or the pollinators too. And basically, we just don't know to what extent. There are some places that are studying native bees and bumblebees and other types of bees, but a lot of them, I mean, we don't even know a lot what's happening with honeybees, let alone some of the other ones. So when I talk about honeybees, there's seven species that fall in the genus Apis that are counted as honeybees. But, you know, overall with bees, we think there's, you know, there's tens of thousands. There's over 400 in Michigan. And this is our girl. This is the big pollinator. And you can see with her little pollen baskets on there. So this is Apis mellifera. This is the western honeybee. And this is the one that everyone who keeps bees in their backyard in a box, it's going to be these. And all the beekeepers are keeping exactly this species of bees in the U.S. Are they native to the U.S.? Who thinks yes? Who thinks no? You guys are all nervous because you're on camera. Okay. So this is their current range. So I said there's seven species. Most of them are all in China, Southeast Asia. But this big red region, that's the honeybee. That's Apis mellifera. And it's able to live almost all over the world. You can see that it lives pretty much everywhere except for Arctic and on the Sahara. And that's for two main reasons. And it has adapted to thermoregulate its hive. So it lives usually in tree holes or big empty trees. And it's able to cluster into a tight ball to keep warm in the winter. And in the summer, it actually can fan to produce airflow in there. So you can live in a wide range of temperatures if you can regulate the temperature of your home. Which, keep in mind, these are insects that are able to do this. So that's pretty amazing. The second thing is that their food source is flowers. That's the only thing that bees can eat is flowers. They use the pollen for protein, and they use the nectar as their carbohydrate source. So in the absence of flowers, bees have no food. Well, what flowers do we have out right now? Not many. And how many are we going to have in about a month from now? None. And so bees have adapted, though, that they can actually live through here. And the way they do that is by storing up food in those times of plenty to get them through the times when they don't have blooms available. And that is why they can have these huge ranges. And they do that by storing honey. And so they collect nectar all summer long, and they actually dehydrate it down into a form that's not going to ferment and not going to rot. And they can store that as honey. And then they collect pollen, and they ferment it, so that they're allowed to keep it over the winter. So they're dehydrating and fermenting, just like good grandmas are doing, and storing food to get through the winter. And they're able to do this as insects. And that allows them to live in these ranges where they don't have a constant food supply. So this is their native range. There are lots of different subspecies, or like breeds of bees. And they came from Africa and from Western Europe, Mediterranean region. And that is important when we think about, you know, how us as beekeepers, how we're taking care of them, to think about the regions that they're actually adapted to. In the U.S., the estimation is that we have about 200,000 beekeepers, and they're split into three different categories. So a commercial beekeeper is, in Michigan, I think it's over 300 hives or over 400 hives to join the commercial beekeeping group, and you have to be making your whole income from bees. We also have a group that we call sideliners, where you make part of your income from honeybees. And then this is a really growing group, the backyard or the hobbyist group. So sideliners have, you know, between 20 and 300 hives. And backyard hobbyists, there's a lot where you can actually, in Ann Arbor, you can have two hives in your backyard. And a lot of people have just a few hives just for fun. And one thing, too, in Michigan, we have no registration. So we think we're in the couple hundreds of beekeepers, but we have no idea how many. But we probably have between 50 and 100 large commercial operations. And some of these commercial operations can get over 10,000 colonies. So here's colonies out probably in the Dakotas somewhere that are quite large. And the reason that they have to be so large is because of these pollination contracts. And so this is a picture of the almond trees. And so these are the almond orchards. And so in the Central California valleys, we have acres and acres and acres of almond orchards. And in those regions, there's only almonds. And so, and almonds are something that do require insect pollination to actually set fruit. And so we have to bring in 1.5 million colonies from all over the U.S. to that one region just to provide pollination so that we can have almonds. And that, you know, the 2 weeks while they're blooming, all of these bees, millions of hives are there. And then they have to leave once there's no more food available. And so this is what happens, is that we have this system now of migratory beekeeping. And so this is a figure from Scientific American. And you can see at the bottom, the dark blue is February. So almond bloom is generally the second, third week of February. And most of our bees in the United States are over in California. Some are overwintering down in Florida. But they, most of them, 1.5 million or so, go to California for this almond pollination. And then, so almond is a really good food source for them. The bees build up on almonds. They do fine. And then they go to Washington for apples or pears, or they come to Michigan, or they go up to Maine for blueberries, or they go to Wisconsin for cranberries. And so these different beekeepers will have different pollination contracts, and they actually are honeybee brokers that will determine, you know, who goes to which area. And they'll go to make sure that all of these foods in the United States will get pollinated. And so like I said, they build up on these different fruits, and these people have to truck them to all these different locations. So as the colony builds up and as it gets larger, the beekeepers actually have to do something with these bees. They can't keep bringing more and more bees to each location, and they'd be over weight limits. And so what they do is they shake them into these boxes. This is called a package. And they'll shake them into these boxes. They'll add a queen from a commercial queen producer, and they'll sell these. And so if you're a hobbyist in Michigan, generally this is the way you'll get your bees. And they're in 2 or 3 pound packages, and they have come shake off of these big commercial operations, and you'll order your package in Michigan. Excuse me. You'll order your package, and someone who goes down and their job is to go get bees from Florida or from Georgia or from California will go out with a flatbed truck or refrigerated truck and bring them back and distribute them to beekeepers in our region. So right now, even the hobbyists, you know, they may not realize it, are playing a part of this big nationwide commercial beekeeping scheme. So let's say you are a beekeeper in Michigan, though. So like I said, 1.5 million hives do this, or, you know, over a million hives do that. But a lot of people just keep bees just in Michigan. And if you're a beekeeper, how you keep your bees is really, really closely dependent on what plants are available and the weather and climate. So like I said, the only source of food for bees is flowers. And so as a beekeeper, you're also half botanist. And so you're constantly paying attention to what foods are available. And is the weather nice enough that my bees can go out and fly and get food from it? This is a picture of the basswood or linden tree. This is an incredibly important honey producer plant in Michigan. This is one of our major food sources for bees. And so what happens for bees in Michigan is they start small in the spring. The colony builds up as we have all of those plants blooming. And then in the winter, it dies down again and gets much smaller as they prepare to make it through the winter. And so you'll see something like this. So this is standard overwintering size in the wintertime. But in the summer, those same colonies will get very, very, very tall. And this year we had a great honey year, and I even had colonies. I had to stand on a chair behind the hives to climb up, and they were 10 boxes tall, which I could have taken some honey off, but they were up by the road, so I was kind of showing off a little too. But it was, I mean, so they do get very, very large in Michigan. And the reason that they do that is because we have such a cold climate, all of our flowers have to bloom kind of at one period, which is really May, June, and then we have nothing the rest of the year. So during that bloom time, there is really a huge excess of honey. Right now, what we're waiting on are these first early spring flowers. So there's a couple asters out, but really there's nothing for the bees to get. Their next food source are going to be, you know, some crocuses, but willows and maples, so some of these early trees that bloom, and that'll be the first thing that's available for them. So early spring in Michigan, they have what's called the buildup. So they're trying to build their population so that they have enough bees to go out and feed off of all of these flowers. And so they start raising brood, which is the term for young larvae and pupa, and they're building up their workforce. And then the late spring, early summer, that's what we call our honey flow. I mean, and you can think about it too, in Michigan in May and June, there's flowers everywhere. It's a really beautiful time to be here. And especially as a bee and as a beekeeper, it's a really beautiful time because there's food everywhere. Midsummer, we often have a dearth, which is a term that we use when there's not much food available. And a lot of that has to do with just dry conditions. This year we didn't because we had lovely, lovely rain. But a lot of the flowers, even if they're in bloom, like the white Dutch clover in the lawn, it's very shallow rooted. And if there's not enough rain, they're not putting out nectar. And then in the late summer, early fall, we have a secondary honey flow. So that's goldenrods and asters. And that's really, really temperature dependent about whether or not the bees can actually go out and get those. And then after the asters are done, which is pretty much where we are now, that's kind of it for bees. So we're hoping really that in this big main honey flow that they were able to bring enough to get through the whole year. Okay, so that's kind of what's happening in beekeeping. So I'm going to do the sad part now. And then there's another happy part at the end, so I'm not going to leave you in the pits of despair. So I'm going to talk about the problems in beekeeping. So, I mean, everybody, I'm sure, is aware that things are going on for bees, and it's a really difficult time to be a bee. It used to be that our annual losses were about 10 to 15%. So if you had 100 hives, you'd probably lose about 10 of them. And that was considered standard, and that's also considered sustainable by most beekeepers, is a 15% loss. Since 2006, we've lost about a third of our bees every year. And that is a level that's not considered sustainable by beekeepers. So they have to make up that loss every single year. And you could imagine, I mean, these are livestock for people and livelihoods. Like, if we lost a third of our cattle every year or a third of our chickens, it would be a huge deal. And then last winter in Michigan, we reported over a 65% loss. So Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and Ontario were between 60 and 70% loss. And for beginner beekeepers and hobbyists, it was about 100%. It was above 80 to 100% loss. And so part of that was just climatic last year, but we're in this era where we're at losses yearly that are considered not sustainable. And this has been actually, the overall decline has been going on for a really long time. So people always think about it in the last few years. But this is a figure of the number of honey-producing colonies, so the number of hives in the U.S. And on the bottom, it starts in 1945. So right after World War II, we had about 5.5 million colonies in the United States. And now we're at about 2.5 million, or just above 2 million. And that's a pretty huge decline that's been happening. And there's a lot of things in play in here. Two things after World War II is, one, we had better living through chemistry. So we had DDT. This is the time that we start producing and using lots and lots of pesticides. And this decline is not necessarily linked to any one of these factors, but that is something that happened around that time. The second thing that happened is honey prices fell. So with globalization, with allowing for the importation of cheaper foreign honey, and with all these different sweeteners being used, honey became less important and American honey became less valuable, and it was just much more difficult to make a living as a beekeeper, as a honey producer. And so a lot of people have switched to pollination contracts, but also a lot of people have gone out of business as well. And then you can see there is a pretty big drop in the 80s and 90s right in here. And I don't know if you can read this. It says parasitic mites introduced into the U.S. And I'm going to talk about that in a bit further. But this is another thing that happens with globalization, is that we have those seven other species, or the six other species of honeybees. And have all of their diseases that they've adapted to. Well, now when we're transporting bees, you know, we're transporting all over the U.S., but they get transported all over the world, too. And with that gets the transportation of their pests and diseases. And so our honeybees are having to face all these different pests and diseases that they've never come into contact with, and they have no defenses for as well. And then here you can see in big red letters CCD. And that's when we first started to see colony collapse disorder. And colony collapse disorder is a really specific thing that happens. And so in that, we see that the colony is essentially emptied out, and maybe the queen is left, but most of the bees are gone. And that was something that was new and scary, but it kind of gets used synonymously with the loss of honeybees or the problems that affect honeybees. And so we still have all of these huge, huge losses, like that 30% or that 60% each year, but it's not necessarily CCD. CCD is a very specific thing that makes up a portion of all of those losses. So this is that mite. This is a really terrible picture. I'm sorry. It's sad. But here you can see these big red scales on here, and that's the mite, Varroa destructor. It's very aptly named. It's incredibly large for the size of the bee, and it actually comes on, cuts a hole in their cuticle or their hard skeleton, and will start to suck their blood or their hemolymph, which is their version of blood. And so just physically, you can see how damaging that would be. Someone told me once that the size analogy is like if we had a parasite the size of a rat sucking your blood, you know, it's quite large. And I think that emotional response is really apt too. I mean, this is a very devastating thing to have for a honeybee. But not only that, but it's actually the vector for many, many viruses as well. So when it cuts into them, it actually transmits viruses into them. And there's some viruses that the honeybees have been able to live with just fine having them in the hive, but once it gets injected, it actually causes really devastating effects. So this in the United States we know is behind a lot of the problems that we've been having. Our honeybees are not, they don't have a very long relationship with it. They're not well adapted to take care of them or to get rid of them from the hive, and we don't have very good tools for them yet to solve it. So there are some things that a beekeeper can do throughout the year to try to break the reproductive cycle of this mite, and we do have some chemical treatments against it, but none of them really work that well. We don't have a silver bullet, and the big reason is you're trying to kill a little big bug on a big bug, you know, and so you're trying to find something that's going to damage this without damaging the big bee, and we're just not there yet. And so I talked about globalization bringing in all these diseases, but also when we transport over half the colonies into a single area and have them all sitting close to each other, that's a really great way to spread diseases. I mean, if we brought everyone in the U.S. all to the same point, and you had the stress of travel and all of that, and you're only on one single food source during all of that, and then everyone has to mix together, and then you go back all home, you can think about how easily diseases get transported all across the United States. And so because we're so homogenous with how we treat bees in the United States, when we get diseases in a single area, it spreads quite rapidly throughout the country. Pesticides. So that's another thing that is getting a lot of news attention right now. A lot of crop pests are insects. And so there are a lot of, you know, for example, the potato industry has many insect pests that will absolutely destroy it. In order for us to eat those foods, they actually have to keep and manage their insects and then to keep them under control. And so we know that a lot of pesticides are designed to kill insects. And what are bees? Insects. And so when these get used in ways that can kill bees, you can actually have huge pollinator die-offs. But we also know that there are pesticides that aren't targeted against bees that can have huge effects, and some of that is due to adjuvants or things that are in the pesticides, those not the actual active ingredients, but all the other things can affect the bees. And then fungicides and things like that that don't target bees at all, we're starting to find, or it starts to seem that it actually affects their digestion and their ability to make the bee bread, which is their fermented pollen, that needs this microbial balance, and those things seem to be disrupted. So we don't have a clear picture on pesticides. There are some countries that are calling for bans on certain types of pesticides, But we do know, I mean, we know at minimum there are plenty of things that are designed to kill insects that affect bees. And there are many things that aren't designed to kill them that can do a lot worse as well. We also have loss of foraging land, and part of that is due to farming practices. So there's a couple of pictures up here. You have this lovely, lovely field. We used to raise a lot of our animals on hay and on hay fields, which required lots and lots of pasture land and hay fields. And both of those often had flowers. Nowadays, we raise our animals on corn, and those areas do not generally have flowers. And so just in changing practices, we've gotten rid of a lot of the fields that we used to have that could support a pollinator population. The other thing is how we manage weeds. So it used to be that a farmer would have a particular cash crop, and then in the off season, once they harvested that, they'd plant a cover crop. And a lot of this, so this is, I don't know if you guys recognize that, that's buckwheat. That's a really common cover crop that people would use. It's a great honey crop. It produces a really dark honey. But they'll use clovers or vetches or things like that to keep weeds down. Well, now we have Roundup. And so instead of actually planting, you can just get rid of everything that's out there. We also have loss of forage because other things happening to farmland. And a big thing that's happening to farmland, especially Southeast Michigan is one of the biggest places for this, is that it gets developed. And so you have this land that's, even when you have farms, you often have, you know, rows in between, or you have forested, or you have areas that aren't fully drained that can support pollinators. And then we have these developments move in and that get rid of that vacant land or that farmland that's supporting pollinators. And you see farmland turn into this. And this is where, if you are a landscaper or if you're a beekeeper, you're going to view this property very, very different. If you're a real estate agent, you're like, yes, it's beautiful. You know, that lovely land. But if I'm driving through as a beekeeper, like, where is a bee going to eat there? Or where are any bugs going to eat there? So maybe, I don't know, maybe that's a tree that'll bloom for 2 weeks. But in between there, I mean, this is an absolute desert. And you'll notice, like, if you start keeping bees or if you start becoming interested in pollinators, you know, one thing is you're constantly aware of what's in bloom. If you go to any of the bee meetings, people are like, oh, black locust is happening, or goldenrod should start in 2 days. And you're constantly talking about when these food sources, but you'll also notice as you're driving, you're constantly looking like, oh, that person used native plants. So you're like, this is an absolute desert. You know, if I put my bees on here, there's nothing for them there. That's considered a food desert. And this house is probably not just in this little island of green lawn. You know, you have rows and rows and rows of all of these houses, and there's absolutely no food there to support any sort of pollinator population. And so when people find out that I'm a beekeeper, probably the second question is, oh, well, what's happening to the bees? And this is the standard response that I give and that most scientists will give. And it's that we have these multiple interacting causes of death. And Marla Spivak, who's a name down there that you can see, she does a really lovely TED Talk on this. She's won the MacArthur Genius Award for her work on honeybees. She's at the University of Minnesota. And, I mean, well-deserved. She's a great researcher. And she has this analogy that she uses in this TED Talk, is that, you know, imagine that you're sick with a virus, which I'm just getting over a cold, as you can probably hear, so I'm very empathetic. This rings true for me. And let's say you're hungry and you want to make some soup, and you go to your house and you don't have any food, and you go to the nearest store and there's no food because, you know, all the forage is gone. And so you have to travel even further while you're sick to find food. And when you get there, there's only one or two types of food, and they're laced with pesticides. And those pesticides affect your immune system that cause you to get secondary diseases or not get over this disease that you got, which came in from who knows where in the first place. And so we think that it is this combination of that, you know, these diseases have come in that are new for the honeybees, but they're also stressed from having pesticides that are affecting them in multiple ways. And they're getting a combination of these pesticides. They've got this flowerless landscape that's taking over in the United States, so they don't have food resources, and then these monocultures, so that if they do have food, they're getting a single type of food for just a little bit of time, and then they have to be moved to the next place. And so we do think it is, there really isn't, a very simple answer, which is hard because complex problems are much more difficult to solve than if we had something that we could just pin our finger on, you know, just the pesticides or just the farming practices or things like that. And just to remind you, so that was a lot on honeybees, but this is a mason bee, one of our Michigan natives, and what is bad for the honeybee is bad for the mason bee. So we know a lot about how it affects honeybees, but we actually haven't even surveyed a lot. We don't even know how many bees should be in a lot of these areas. But we do know that populations are dropping and it's happening to them as well. Okay, so that was the sad part. Now we're getting the happy part of what you can actually do to protect pollinators. So consider unused spaces. So don't mow or spray your ditches. And you can actually ask the county not to mow if you live out in the country, and add native flowering plants to that. And I'm part of the Eastern Apicultural Society, and they were at last year's meeting talking about requiring a 10% of your property be put into pollinator habitat. Because like there's always an area like behind the pine trees that you mow, or that part behind your shed that you mow for some reason, but you wouldn't necessarily have to do. And 10% seems really, really small. And you're not going to be supporting huge populations unless you own a ton of land. But what you can do is provide these little pockets that can allow pollinators to jump. You know, if there's a big park or a big nature area here, but you've got acres and acres and acres of lawn, and then there's another thing where plants will bloom at a different time over there, sometimes the pollinators can't get from here to there because it's just an empty desert in between. Whereas if they have these little pit stops where they can get food, or if they can have diversity of food by the things that you plant or by the things that you leave, it can allow them, you know, to get to these areas that can fully support them. So even if you have tiny lawns, this is something that you can do. And rethink what you actually have in your lawn. So these things, like I said, like if you're a landscaper, they're pests. If you're a beekeeper, these are two huge honey plants. Dandelions, that's the sign that I can breathe a sigh of relief in the spring. Once dandelions come out, that's their first major food source that they have available. And the nice thing about these two, dandelions and the white Dutch clover, is they bloom all summer long. So they bloom during that drought or that dearth period. And these are actually really important. And you know, a lot of people automatically put a weed in feed on their yard. So something that kills, you know, like 2,4-D that will kill these guys out there, or they'll mow their lawn. It's so hard as a beekeeper when you see all those dandelions bloom and then you pass all these places and people are mowing them down to like golf course green height, you know, and you just see all these, it's beautiful yellow and then it just goes this like empty, empty green. But you can just even set the height of your mower higher to allow for those blossoms. Having, you know, rethinking what you think is a beautiful lawn can actually make a big difference. And then obviously planting flowers. So perennials are good. They're usually more nutritious food sources. So you can see a lot of the herbs, like lavender is a really good source. Flowering trees are really important. And like I said, a lot of the trees that flower are maples and basswoods and things like that that you wouldn't necessarily think of a flowering tree. But those are huge food sources because there's thousands or tens of thousands of blossoms in a single area. So in terms of actually putting the most food in a particular spot, even just planting trees that bees use is important. And then things that bloom for a really long time. So the sunflower is up here because it usually blooms in late summer, in those periods where we don't have much blooming or much food available for the bees. And so thinking about when you time your planting. And here's just kind of a weird graphic on that. But the blue is kind of, and this is obviously not for Michigan because I don't know what we would have blooming in January. But you can see there's this big peak of April, May, June of when stuff is available in nature. And then you try to time it, like maybe you plant crocuses or things that are really, really early. And then you try to time it so that you have things that are really late in the summer as well. So if you're planted for bees, you can actually time it too so that it's a time that they'll actually use it or it's really useful for them. And think about before you spray or before you buy. So cut flowers often have pesticides, and a lot of the plants that you buy from nurseries, some of them will have, actually are impregnated with pesticides, including bee-friendly plants will have neonicotinoids that are shown to be damaging to bees. And that's because if you're making your living as a you know, producing flowers, you want to produce a really, really beautiful, not bug-infested flower. And you're not necessarily thinking about it as a food source for pollinators. This is actually a happy story. So this is, you can see the date on there. Well, this was last year. It says February 10th to 16th. So around Valentine's Day last year, they had these protests at Lowe's and Home Depot because they were doing exactly that. They were selling these pollinator-friendly plants that actually had pesticides. And there was this huge grassroots movement against it, and all of these businesses have either stopped doing that or they're labeling them. So you are able to find places that are labeling that this is a pesticide-free plant when you buy it. But there are also, there's an Ann Arbor seed company that sells organic seeds, and you can also, you know, planting from seeds or planting from a local nursery that can tell you whether or not it has pesticides in it is the best thing. And then think about what you're using in your yard and how you're using it. So it's not necessarily that you can't ever use a chemical to protect a plant ever, but you can, you know, spray, like if you have to use a fungicide on your roses, for example, you can spray at night when there aren't going to be the bees likely to be on it. Or you can try to spray something after it's bloomed, and so then it's not going to be something that the bees are going to use. But just being aware, so there's a common misconception that if it's on the shelf and it's available to consumers, that it must be fairly safe. And for insects, that's absolutely not true at all. You can destroy everything in your yard if you wanted to. There's actually a beekeeper that I know that went out and bought some stuff to sprinkle in her yard to keep wood ticks down because her dogs were getting wood ticks. Well, it was 7, which is incredibly damaging to bees, and her bees got into it, and she had a huge die-off in her hive. But, you know, there's this thought that, like, you get this pretty colored package on the store shelf that it's not going to be as incredibly damaging as it is, and some of them are actually really bad. And then these are pictures of native bee habitats. So not everybody has to become a beekeeper. I can be the first to tell you that's an incredible amount of work. But one of the things that happens when we're developing and we're putting sod in everywhere, which is not our native landscape, is we're losing habitat for our native bees as well. And so there's tons of designs and really pretty pictures, and they don't have to be this nice either, of providing places for these solitary bees to live, or providing even just having patches of sand or leaving dirt alone in your yard and not trying to force the grass there. There are burrowing bees that absolutely need that habitat. And there are tons of resources right now. That's probably the best thing that's come out of all of these bad things that happened to bees, is there are a lot of people who are stepping up to take action on it. This top one, the Xerces Society, is by far the best resource, and they put out this book, Attracting Native Pollinators, but they are a group designed for invertebrate conservation, and they have just an absolute wealth of resources. The Bee Informed Partnership, they do a lot of collecting of data of beekeepers and management practices in the United States. Pollinator.org is the pollinator partnership, and they have a lot of planting guides, but you can find planting guides. So if you're looking at bee-friendly plants, those are all available on the internet. And the University of Minnesota actually keeps planting guides as well. So if you're looking for things that do well, especially if you're looking for native plants that do well in your region, there's tons of resources of what you can actually plant. So thank you, and I think I can take questions now. So the question is that how you get bees back in the box to transport them. So all of these people who are doing the migratory beekeeping, and that's actually a really good question. And the bees will generally return to the colony at nighttime. So they only leave during the day to go out and forage, and at night they'll come back in. So when you're transporting a colony, you'll either transport it at night, or more likely you'll close them up at night and you'll load them onto the truck, and then they'll put a big net over the whole truck to transport them. So the question is if it's an international problem. It is an international problem to varying degrees in different places. But the pesticide issue, the major die-offs and the diseases, like, for example, Australia doesn't have varroa destructor yet. But in different places, like Greece seems to not have as many problems as we do, but in Europe, definitely we have the huge die-offs. In Canada, it's just as bad as we are here. So yeah, it's an international issue. Mm-hmm. No, I think that is the point was about the importance of biological and other forms of pest control. I think there is actually a really huge movement towards, even amongst beekeepers, historically a lot of people have just put chemicals in their hives to protect their bees. And now I think there's a lot more education on integrated pest management, of actually monitoring to make sure your problem, using other things when they're available.
Speaking of Minnesota, I'm from Edina, Minnesota, where I grow over 100 roses and a lot of other things. And one of our biggest problems in recent years has been the Japanese beetle. And I hear this gentleman mentioning lady beetles. And I think throughout this region, as the Japanese beetle has penetrated from the warmer climate, if we see more and more of them, the first line of defense was imidacloprid, which is the primary neonicotinoid that she's talking about. And it doesn't work very well. It lasts about 7 or 8 days. You have to spray it again. And it's very, we believe, quite toxic to the bees. The other one is the pyrethroids. And, like, for example, the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum this year is using Temple, which is a very vicious pyrethroid. Okay, and I've been using another pyrethroid for Japanese beetles. And I am convinced that, I know it kills lady beetles. I'm convinced that you're taking out all the beneficials at the same time. And it's a vicious cycle. What I want to tell you, and this is an observation and a question, whether you agree with the Japanese beetle thing, but this year, I want to recommend a book. I found a book called Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden by Jessica Walliser. It's a new book. And said many of the things that you've been talking about planting species with it for pollen and that sort of thing to attract beneficial bugs. But I completely stopped using any pesticides in my garden. What happened in 1 year is I had a swarm of mason bees, okay, and interspersed in the mason bees, many honeybees. I don't know where they're coming from, but they're native. They're around. Nobody's keeping them in my neighborhood. So without the use of pyrethroids or imidacloprid, we have a swarm of bees and also a lot of predatory wasps. So it does happen when you stop using. My question is, do you subscribe to that theory? I imagine you do.
No, I mean, on a small scale, for sure. There is a big movement among beekeepers to call for an outright ban on a lot of these types of pesticides, and I personally don't agree with that, just because, you know, some cases there are a better alternative, but in some cases there aren't. And what they'd be going back to are the more potent neurotoxins that we use, the organophosphates. So some of them that we're using now affect bees, but the previous ones affected bees and were incredibly damaging on people. And some of them, I mean, we're not growing food on a large scale for fun. You know, like, we're growing it on a large scale because we have to feed lots of people. And so in those cases where you have, you know, large swaths of land, sometimes producers' hands are tied. But definitely, like, for small-scale people, or for small-scale producers, or for people in your own yards, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree. By just improving that ecosystem and allowing things to be better in balance, you're able to keep down these major pests by using the predators.
One over here. Mm-hmm. Do bees ever rest?
That's actually a really good question, because they do have the, you know, they always say busy as a bee, but they actually spend, I probably shouldn't give their secret away because that's a good reputation in the United States, but they actually do spend a lot of time resting. So if you open a hive on the comb, and there is someone who studied this about, they actually monitor, because you can have hives that have glass walls, so you can see what they do during the day, and you can put little tags and monitor which each bee does during the day, and there are plenty of grad students who do that. And they spend a good portion of their day just kind of hanging out in the hive.
What are the health benefits of the honey, and how much
honey you would recommend a day for a person?
The health benefits of honey and how much you recommend. The nice thing about honey is that, you know, there's nothing, well, if you have actual true honey, so a lot of things that are packaged, there have been some issues of what's been imported as honey, but if you get locally, like, known honey, the nice thing about it is that it's completely digestible by humans. So there's nothing in there that's unnatural, and it's really, really simple sugar, so it's incredibly easy for your body to access the energy that's in it. And there are benefits of having very, very tiny doses of the local pollen that's in the honey as well. I don't have a recommendation. I'm definitely not a physician, so I don't have a recommendation. But there's, people will use anything that comes out of a beehive. You know, people will sell and use the honey. They'll use the resin that they use to glue up the hive, the propolis, the pollen. People will eat the royal jelly, which is the substance that they secrete to feed the queens. They'll eat drone larvae in many places. So, and I went to a store in China where they just sold all products from the hive, and the guy only hired really young, attractive girls, and he said, oh, no, they're just normal. They just eat honey all of the time, and it makes you beautiful, and it takes, you know, adds years to your life. So apparently it did everything there.
This mm-hmm. is actually a question about royal jelly in particular. So let's say that we got people on a level, say people at that 10% started planting back with native planting, and we planted plants that say were like anti-mutagenics or anti-parasitics in that 10%. Is it potential through royal jelly that you would better the immune system of the next up-and-coming hive, potentially?
I see. So your question is, if you're doing a lot more planting, the nutrition will actually, so the way that royal jelly is produced is that it's a glandular secretion from a gland in the head of really, really young bees. And it's really, really high protein. So for a bee to produce it, it takes a lot of energy. And so one of the reasons that colonies are so hard to study is because a lot of the effects can happen many generations away. And one of the things that happens is that you have a bee that was raised under stress. So when it was a larva or a pupa, it wasn't fed very well. So it didn't have enough royal jelly, or didn't have a great amount or great quality of royal jelly, and it wasn't raised well. And then that bee is going to turn into an adult bee, or that larva will turn into an adult bee that maybe is weaker, or has a different immune system, or is unable to produce as much royal jelly, and then that weakened bee is going to be the one that's producing the food for the next generation. And so sometimes with our bees, we have these very, very gradual die-offs, and a lot of it is due to nutrition. So a lot of times your bee die-off could actually be due to the fact that you had not enough pollen resources in August, because those bees were the ones that fed those bees that have fed those bees that were the ones that were supposed to make it through the winter, but everybody was too weak. So I think microphone.
I've been a honey fan for many years, but about 15 years ago, I developed a sensitivity to it, and I can't eat it now. And I don't know why. I haven't seen anything in research, so I just wondered if you knew of anything about that.
Well, I do know that, so there are trace amounts of pollen in honey. Unless you do a really, really high heat, high filtration, it should have pollen in it to be considered honey. And you can have reactions to those pollen. We do know that people have had life-threatening reactions to eating royal jelly, but also, you can buy at health food stores, you can just buy bottles of pollen. And if you have a mild allergy of breathing in pollen, sometimes when you eat it, you can have a much worse reaction because you're giving yourself something that your body can't or doesn't respond appropriately to, but you're giving it in a different way. So, I mean, again, I'm not a physician, but my guess is that it's the pollen that's in there that's affecting it. So I've definitely, just anecdotally, I've had different types of honey that will all of a sudden I'll start sneezing controllably from eating a type of honey. You know, and I mean, I eat honey all of the time, you know, and I've never, but we'll go to like honey tastings and things like that. And some of them, and I've known other people who have like their lips will swell, and it's most likely due to the types of pollen that are in that particular honey.
I had a suggestion. Wouldn't it behoove the beekeepers to more or less pool the resources and buy land and then cultivate that land with specific pollinator, you know, crops that would pollinate throughout different sections of the year? So when one crop expired, another one would come up and so on and so forth, and that would help to more or less offset some of the things you've been talking about.
Yeah, so land use is actually really important. There's a couple, I'm glad you brought that up. So one thing that beekeepers do a lot is work with state land. So a bee flies about 3 miles when it goes out to forage. And so that's, you know, well, or it can go up to 7 miles if it really has to. So you're talking about thousands of acres that they're covering. One thing that we do in the United States is, you know, use state land or use federal land. Another thing is partnering with Pheasants Forever or other conservation organizations. There are a lot of beekeeping groups that are doing that, because a lot of times, especially some of them will plant buckwheat or other crops that will attract wildlife or game animals and also are good for bees. There has been something put out from the federal government this past year where beekeepers can actually get funding to put their land back in conservation or to plant for funding. So if you have at least 5 hives, you can actually apply for funding to plant for land or for pollinators. And then the other thing too is now that we have a farm bill, there's actually incentives for farmers to put their land in conservation. And so we used to have millions and millions of more acres of land, and then we didn't have a farm bill, and farmers were actually taking it out of conservation because they weren't getting their payments. And now that that's back, that's helping. But it does take, the estimate, it depends on what types of plants are there, because, you know, honeybees are animals, so they need different amino acids, and different foods are more nutritious than other ones. But it's about 1 acre of food in constant bloom per hive. So it's actually a huge, because if you think about it, you know, they're going to a flower, and they're taking just the teeny tiniest sip, and then they're going to bring that back, and then they're going to dehydrate that down, and then, you know, they're getting like a minuscule amount per each flower or per each floral visit. And so having, that's why trees are really important, but, you know, you actually need huge amounts of land. But yeah, there are a lot of things happening. And one bill that's actually, I believe it's still in committee, I have to check, but it's looking so that states will put right-of-ways or road easements into planting them for pollinators, because right now they mostly just get mowed or they're just grass, but actually using those spaces for pollinators. So that's something that's federal, but it's going to be done at the state level.
Are there long term studies being done?
On what?
The pollinators and the bees you were talking about that you needed to know over time what would happen, and are they doing any studies?
Yeah, there's quite a few places that are doing research. So Michigan State is actually doing quite a bit of research, but there's quite a few other ag schools that are as well, and independent organizations. The problem with honeybees is that there's only so many things you can do in the lab to them, and a lot of the big problems that happen out in the field. And so when you're trying to study something that's going to fly for miles and miles and miles, it's hard to figure out what they come into contact with. And so they're coming into contact with, you know, 15 different pesticides and 20 different viruses. And so it is hard to pin down. But there are quite a few studies, and there's actually been new federal funding right now for pollinator protection. And so there are new studies that are happening as well.
Could you talk a little about the queen bee, where she comes from? Is she born into her role? What do they protect her? What happens when she dies?
Yeah.
Is there a queen in waiting?
She's my favorite bee. So I mean, most of what I do is sell queens and breed queens. So the queen bee, there's usually one. Every now and then two per hive, but the normal operating is to have one queen per hive. She's not very appropriately named. She's called the queen, but she's not really in charge. Her main job is to be an egg layer. And so she's the big reproductive force. So she can lay at maximum about 1,500 eggs a day. And it used to be that she lived for, like, on average 5 years or 3 to 5 years. Nowadays, one of the problems that we're having is they live for about, on average, a year and a half. And we don't know why exactly. But she is a female, and all of the workers are females. And genetically, at the egg stage, any of those female eggs could become a queen. And for, once an egg is an egg for 3 days, and then it hatches into a larva, and for those first few days, all of the larvae get fed royal jelly. And then if it's a worker bee, it gets fed a mixture of royal jelly and bee bread, that pollen, the fermented pollen. If it's going to be a queen, it gets fed only royal jelly for the rest, and tons of it, tons and tons of royal jelly. And so genetically, it's exactly the same, but something in the way that she's food causes her to actually different genes to switch on. And when she pupates, she emerges quite differently. So her legs are very different. She doesn't have the pollen baskets. And she has a much longer abdomen. And her venom sac structure is very different. So what turns into a big stinger in bees actually is an ovary and an organ for storing sperm in the queen. And so she's morphologically completely different. And then so she hatches out after 16 days after she was laid. And she kind of takes a few days to stretch out and dry out, and then she'll go out on a mating flight or two, and she'll go out and mate with hopefully 15 to 20 drones. We like promiscuous queens because that means genetic diversity within the hive, and then she'll come back, and she'll store that sperm inside of her, and she'll never leave the hive again in a normal scenario, and so she'll just get to work laying eggs. The other thing that she does is that, so bees communicate by scent almost exclusively, and so they have all these pheromones, and she secretes these pheromones that are essentially are kind of like, I'm all right, or, everything's all right, I'm here pheromones. So as long as there's a queen in the hive, as beekeepers we call that queen right, and a queen right hive, a hive that has a queen in it, acts in a completely different way than a hive that doesn't have a queen, and that's because that means that that colony can reproduce and can grow. I mean, the big thing is, because as bees are dying off, she's the one who's in charge of replacing that, so you have kind of this constant colony.
So some hives don't have a queen.
If they lose, so she said some hives don't have a queen. If they lose their queen, so for example, if she dies of old age, or if she runs out of sperm, they'll actually kill her. The bees will hopefully be able to raise a new queen out of another egg that's there. If they can, or out of another young larva that's there, if they can catch it in time. If they don't catch it in time, that's actually, that colony is dead. So they, because you have bees as little organisms, but the real organism in terms of what reproduces in biology is that super organism of the colony. And so without workers or without brood or without a queen, they can't live, like bees can't live out in nature alone for only just a couple days and they'll die. And so you have to have that whole thing to be intact to survive for honeybees. Different bees will do this differently. But yeah, so for honeybees, if they don't have a queen, they're not, no one else can lay female eggs. So no one else can replace that workforce. So that means that colony is done effectively. So as a beekeeper, you have to be able to recognize it and replace it if they can't replace it. Otherwise, the colony is dead.
Yes. How many flowers are pollinated by one bee?
Oh, man. I used to know this because then there's also the fact of how many flowers are necessary for a tablespoon of honey. I'm not sure. I don't remember. And it, a big part of it depends on the time of year and the age. So the foragers, a bee, so I talked about how a bee will start out as a nurse bee and will feed the larva after it hatches. And then it'll become a house bee, and it'll build wax and clean up around the hive. And then as it gets older, it becomes a forager. So that's the last part of its life. So some bees don't make it to that point, but most bees die because of the stress of foraging. And so that length of time that they're foraging, it could be, you know, 40 days or 60 days or 10 days because they'll go out and get eaten. So, I mean, a big part of it is how many they go out. I don't know how many floral visits that a particular bee will do, though.
I took a linguistics class a while back, and they used a demonstration of non-human speech, more or less, as honeybees would go in, the worker bee would go into the hive and do a dance, more or less, and tell the other bees where the honey was, or where the pollen mm-hmm. was. And is that true?
Yeah, no, that is true. They actually, that's one of the most beautiful and fascinating parts about honeybees, is how they communicate. And they can communicate things like go over this building, and they can communicate numbers, and they can communicate distances, and they do it all within, you know, a very, very small space on the honeycomb, and based on the direction of the dance to the direction of the sun, and they can account for the changing angle of the sun during the time that they're in the hive. So if they're saying, you know, go in the opposite direction of the sun, but as the sun changes, you know, during the day, they'll adjust their dance accordingly. I mean, their communication skills are absolutely amazing, the complexity of the information that they can pass on.
And what kind of protection you wear to avoid stings?
So I always wear a veil. And there are some beekeepers that'll go out and that are all tough and say that they don't have it. First off, nobody likes to look at you after you've got stung in the eye. And I don't like to get stung in the face. And another thing is that I get stung hundreds of times a year, and I've never had a bad reaction, and I don't hardly swell up, but you can develop an allergic reaction to honeybees. You know, it could be my next sting. So I do wear personal equipment. But I have a full suit that occasionally I'll have to wear if I have a really mean hive. But generally, I just wear a veil, or like a little veil and a jacket. Sometimes I wear gloves if it's a mean hive, but sometimes I don't.
Would you talk a little bit about bumblebees and the mason bees in terms of they don't produce honey, or do they? What happens with their pollination, and where do they go, and what do they live on, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. So I know, in full disclosure, I don't want to talk outside my pay grade. I know less about the native bees than I do about honeybees. So many of them are like either individual or they live in very small colonies. So what a lot of the bumblebees will do is they'll have one queen will overwinter by herself, and then she will start raising young, and she'll actually go out and get the food and raise her first group of young by herself. And then once they'll build up, and they create little teeny tiny honey pots. So they will store food, but on a very, very tiny scale. They'll store just enough food so that she can raise them. And then they'll build up a smaller colony, and they'll raise a couple workers, and then drones, the male bees. And then at the end of the season, once they have enough, they'll raise queens. And then those queens will go off over winter independently. The mason bee gets its name because it actually builds like little walls, and they're the ones that will go in to a tube, and they'll lay a larva, and they'll put a food source in with it, and then they'll build a little wall, and then they'll add another one, and then they'll build a little wall, and then that bee in the spring will hatch out and go out and go do essentially the same thing in a different location. So not all of them do the same strategy, and even amongst the honeybees, not all of them do the same strategy as well. Some of them don't build colonies. They just build comb like right outside, hanging from trees or hanging from the sides of cliffs. So there are, there aren't really any other, there's some stingless bees down in South America that will produce some honey to some extent that people manage a little bit, but none of them really produce that. Though people do manage bumblebees for pollination, because one thing I didn't talk about is some plants do much better with a certain type of bee, and bumblebees and their native bees pollinate the plants that are native to the United States much better, which makes sense because they, you know, adapted together. And so, for example, tomato plants do much better with bumblebees. And bumblebees will pollinate inside greenhouses, whereas honeybees will not pollinate inside greenhouses. They'll just run to the window and bang on it to get out. And so there are places that actually breed. There's actually, I think, the only facility in the United States is in Michigan that breeds bumblebees for pollination. And you can buy a box of bumblebees for a greenhouse.
I know where my bumblebees are nesting in my yard. I just happened to see where they went. And it's very close to the insectary that I planted.
Wonderful.
It's alongside of a drain pipe. And they go up inside the drain, not inside the drain pipe, but alongside of it.
Yeah.
It's also very close to my tomatoes, which is very interesting. They're within a few feet of the insectary in the tomatoes.
That is interesting. They'll often use, bumblebees will often go underground. They'll often use old mouse holes.
What?
Mouse holes. Yeah, so if a mouse will dig it out and make this nice little, because when you buy them for pollination, they're in boxes about this big, but they look for like a tube and a little cavity. So mouse nests actually does a really good job for them.
I had a quick question.
Sure.
I've seen bumblebees on my garage boring holes into the fascia board that, you know, is on just a pine board that runs along the garage. And I'm going like, what are they doing? And you can see the wood just kind of coming out as they bore in. So they're probably, you know, using those to lay eggs or something.
Yeah, those are carpenter bees. And not all bumblebees, regular bumblebees won't do that. There's a different genus.
They look a lot like bumblebees.
They look a lot like bumblebees. Mm. You'll notice that their abdomen, their back segment, won't have any stripes on it. It'll be black. Yeah. But yeah, they'll definitely, you'll see they make just absolutely perfectly round holes.
I had a question about buying honey.
Mm-hmm.
How can I tell if I'm buying good quality honey or if it's made in the States or not?
Yeah, that's actually something that they're working on the regulation for honey labeling right now. My best recommendation is to find local honey. In Michigan, to sell honey legally, even under the cottage law, you have to have it labeled from where it's produced. So if you're getting it at the farmer's market or at a place that sells local food, there's, you know, a lot of stores will have a little stand, and it should say that it should have the address of a person on there. If it's somewhere small scale, chances are that it's something that it's good, it's better. But they're starting to do more testing, they're starting to change labeling, but there's arguments still about what exactly is the definition of honey and whether or not it has to have pollen and how much pollen and things like that in it.
I promise this will be my last question. But I just wanted to know, are there any genetic engineering solutions to that mite? That mite reminds me a lot of the bats with white nose disease. Is there, you know, could we genetically engineer a bacteria or something that would kill that mite?
We don't have a BT for the mite. One of the things that they are working on is an RNAi technology for it, to try to develop something that is specific to it. That's actually something that was being done in a lab, and so Monsanto actually picked up the technology for it and is leading it. A lot of the Bayer and Monsanto actually have huge honeybee research facilities, and part of it is probably to cover, you know, some PR issues that they really seriously have to deal with. But part of it, too, is it would behoove them if they could solve some of the issues for bees, too. You know, if they could solve the issue for mites and bees got better, it would take a lot of the finger-pointing away from them. So, I mean, there are reasons. And the people who are doing the research there, I actually know the guy who went to Monsanto. I mean, he's an excellent researcher. They pay a lot more than other places do, so they can get really good researchers. But
could you explain the technology you were just discussing about trying to take care of the mite or kill it off?
So it's a version. I can't explain it very well. I've not worked on it, but it's called RNAi, and it's using genes that can be incorporated into the mites that can, I think the thing that they're going for is to making them infertile. And so it's a way that you can change the mite to make it less aggressive. So instead of changing things that you would put in the environment, you'd actually weaken the mite itself.
How bees are provoked, you know, like when they will sting you?
So honeybees get a bad name from yellow jackets and wasps and things like that. Honeybees, because they will die if they sting you, they actually have barbed stingers, and so when they sting you, it breaks off and they'll eventually die. So for them, their threshold for defense is much higher. Usually it's when they are actually in danger, either that be individually or the colony is at danger. So a lot of times when I get stung, it's because there's one, you know, trapped in my collar that I didn't notice, and it's getting smushed. The other time, too, is in the fall, the bees turn much more aggressive. Because in the spring, there's food everywhere. They have a really long season. And you'll talk to so many beekeepers, especially new beekeepers, that will have this very gentle hive in the spring. And they're like, oh, I never have to use smoke. I never have to wear gloves. My bees are so gentle. You guys who kept bees are laughing because you know. And they're like, oh, my girls are so nice. And then come August, when they have, you know, the reason they develop stingers is to defend their food stores, because everybody loves honey. And, you know, when they actually have a food store to defend and no time to replace it, they get much more aggressive. And those same beekeepers are like, I don't know what happened. You know, they got so mean. So for honeybees, it really is, like, if you open a colony on a nice warm day in May, they're a completely different organism than if you open it, especially, like, if there's a low pressure because there's a storm coming in and it's cold weather and it's a fall day, it'd be completely different. The one difference is the Africanized bees, which are in the news a lot lately. And our honeybees here, when you have nectar, that's your only source of energy, and you can either put that into building or storing honey or into raising young. You know, there's a finite amount of resources coming in. Bees to live in the north have adapted to put it into storing honey. Bees that developed in places that don't have a winter usually put it into building bigger colonies. When you have these excess colony or these excess workers, you can lose a lot more. And so Africanized bees have become, their threshold for what they consider as an attack is much, much lower. The nice thing is that they can't live up here. That doesn't mean someone couldn't accidentally transport them up here, but they can't live up here just because they don't put the resources into storing honey, but they would have a different threshold. Most bees, especially honeybees, like if they're out foraging, if they're on a flower, they have absolutely no interest in you, and they have absolutely, you know, they have nothing to defend there. The only times that I get stung is when I'm actually in there, in the hive, messing with them. Well, thank you so much for your attention and for listening today.